So it's it starts out with the female putting laying an egg and on the olive, inside the olive, and this egg will hatch in about 2 or 3 days. From there, there will be 3 different larval stages that occur inside the olive, and this is the damaging stage, the most damaging stage. Once the larva is ready to pupate, it will emerge from the olive and drop into the soil, and that's where it will pupate.
I need to thank.
Taste cues, tactile cues, and I can learn more in just foraging context, also oviposition and nesting site. And insect learning, I don't know what that stands for, sorry. Don't know where that came from. It was first studied in bees and other social insects because it was thought due to this complex lifestyle of bees that they should need to learn, and they do. And therefore, we have a very rich literature on learning memory in bees and other social insects. So solitary insects, wasps, butterflies, Drosophila, have also been studied, but overall the literature is biased towards homotabolous and social insects. And there's much less done on hemimetabolous insects and more basal life history. Not to say there's nothing done, but relatively it's much less. And so I study the praying mantis. This is a solitary hemimetabolous bentonite predator. It's a very charismatic insect.
Space, right from the forest floor and understory up to the canopy crown. And in this vertical space, there's a variety of factors that differ. One of these is that resource quality and availability do differ in vertical space, such that the canopy crown, at least in temperate systems,
camouflage and hide on some cartons, and it came into the United States via a ship. Oops, how's it doing that?
Use your arrow.
Yeah, don't.
Okay, I didn't mean to hit it at all. At any rate, it was first reported in Allentown, Pennsylvania in 2001. It's believed that it was actually there before then, but because it looks similar to some of the other stink bugs, it was kind of ignored or passed off. However, there was numerous reports of homeowners complaining about these stink bugs accumulating in their houses in the fall. And that's what caused a more increased attention that got this thing identified. From there, it continued into the adjacent states, and by 2004, it was all the way over on the other side of the Mississippi River. They had established colonies both in Oregon and California, so it's moving fast. Then just a month ago, it was reported right here in right in Columbus, Ohio, in somebody's house. The reason, again, that this has been somewhat overlooked is because it looks very similar to some of the other stink bugs that we have. The diagnostic features are the white banding on the antenna. The second to the last segment is white. Fresh specimens or freshly killed specimens have red eyes and red ocelli. After they've dried out, the eyes, compound eyes, become rather dark. You also notice the black and white banding on the exposed areas of the abdomen. On the ventral side, it's light colored, or it may or may not have some gray or black markings. The legs are brown, but they have a faint white banding to them as well. These are just some pictures of the adults, about 5/8 of an inch long, really pretty little bugs. Their life cycles, they start overwintering in homes and protected sites in late September. They emerge in April and begin to mate. The females will lay clusters around 28 eggs on the underside of the leaves. Basically, she is laying eggs from June through September, and there you have various stages of these nymphs appearing all summer long. They undergo 5 instars, 1 week per instar, and again, because they are hatching all summer long, you're going to see various stages of these bugs at one time. Up here in the northern states, they have one generation a year. Where they originated in Southeast Asia, they actually have up to 5 generations a year. So this is a good, important bug to keep an eye out for. These are just some images of the life stages. The eggs are about 5/8, about 5 millimeters. The first instars are more orangey with the black stripes. They tend to stay clustered pretty close to the eggs. Then as they molt, they become a little bit darker. Just some more images. By the second instar, you can see that they have very very noticeable banding on the antenna and the legs. People complain about them looking like ticks. And this is just an image here of how they tend to aggregate on leaves. They tend to hide in the folds of the leaves so they're not noticed. And this one bug up here in the upper left, that is actually a green stink bug. And surprisingly, they have been recorded hanging out with the green stink bug nymphs. The problem with these bugs is that they cause a lot of damage to our fruits and leaves. They in China, they have been recorded causing damage to papyrus species, the pears, all the prunus species, the apples, peaches, apricots, ficus species, persimmon, and citrus. They damage vegetables. Also, real pest on soybeans and other beans, and some ornamentals. In the United States, so far, they have found damage to the Asian pear, prunus species again, raspberries, grapes, and they're noticed both in backyard orchards as well, or backyard home fruit trees as well as orchards. They cause a lot of damage to the beans by actually damaging the immature seeds inside the pod. On ornamentals, we've found the damage on the buddleia, the butterfly bush, rosa species, honeysuckle, and paulownia, which is the empress tree. The type of damage that we see is typical of their order. They have that piercing, sucking proboscis. They are piercing the skin of the fruit, causing weeping and pitting and scarring, which as the season progresses, that damage becomes worse. On apples, we see that cork spot where the surface of the apple is rough-looking. On peaches, again, we have the punctures of the fruit, the weeping and the seeping, and eventual cat-facing of the fruit. It makes these, although it doesn't damage the fruit's flavor, it makes them unmarketable because of their aesthetic looks. The earlier in the season, when they are damaging the fruits and leaves, they have like a water-soaked lesions on them. They can have a stippled appearance, or they can have crow's foot-type lesions. The beans, again, they damage the immature seeds inside the bean. And because of their longevity through the season, they will switch hosts all season long. And I guess the major problem for me is because we get all the phone calls. It's just like the multicolored Asian lady beetle and the box elder bugs. They congregate in homes and protected places in the fall. And if you smash them or disturb them, they emit that foul odor that's typical of stink bugs. Because they're going to be congregating in people's houses, it's usually people who are going to be complaining about them even before the orchardists notice that this is a new pest causing problems. So if you see this bug, you can go to Rutgers website. They are trying to do a survey and keep track of this bug. You can go to the Rutgers website and send samples or images to Ann Nielsen. If you can, we would appreciate if you would actually put these bugs in a small vial of alcohol and ship them. There's a lot of information available on the web. Purdue has a really good fact sheet. Of course, Rutgers has multiple fact sheets. University of Florida has an extensive fact sheet. Maryland, you can see there's a whole host of universities that are really looking at this bug. And last but not least, Ohio State University has a new fact sheet on the stink bug that's in print as we speak. So I want to thank, I guess I stayed in time, huh?
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to thank the OSU professors and the other universities that helped to put this program together. I'd like to thank all of you for staying here with your patience, even though you wanted to hear about entomopathogenic pathogenic nematodes. So thank you.
We have ample time for questions.
I talk fast.
For some of the other stink bugs, planting succession crops of beans, so they always have some beans in the milk stage has been used as a trap crop. Have you looked at anything as far as management strategies?
The question is, have we tried to use a trap crop or something for that type of research? And I don't think they have yet. This is still a fairly new bug, and they're at this point they're still surveying the damage that they see. They haven't done trap cropping yet. It's a good question, though. Any other questions? Yes, sir. We do. The question is, do we have parasitoids that attack these? And we do. There's several parasitic wasps that attack these. Also, there's a tachinid fly that seems to overposit on the eggs. Other questions? Yes.
A lot of the other stink bugs have, you monitor them with their sex pheromones. Is that at all feasible here? Has anybody looked at any sex pheromones?
The question is, have we done any work with this sex pheromones as far as trying to attract them? I'm not sure that we that has been done yet, but I'm sure it's in the works. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Offers a lower diversity of resources for a lot of herbivorous insects because there's just a few major canopy species. Also, this area is a lot harsher in terms of UV radiation and wind speeds. But it also may offer a faster growing foliage with higher nutrients, whereas the understory is more sheltered and has a higher diversity of plants available. Regardless, within this vertical space, the sort of divisions, one can imagine arthropods dividing up their spacing, choosing to live in ways that maximize their acquisition of resources, all the time limiting their predation pressure. So I think these two themes lend themselves well to the idea of enemy-free space, which was basically defined by Jeffries and Lawton as ways of living that reduce a species' vulnerability to one or more species of natural enemy. And I chose to think of this in terms of strata in vertical space. Are there strata that offer arthropods enemy-free or enemy-reduced space? So if I exclude birds from different strata, do I see different effects in arthropod communities? So that's basically my main question. Are there certain strata in the forest canopy or understory that offer refuge from predators? A secondary question are these differences taxon-specific? Do different taxa respond differently to effects of birds? For example, Lepidoptera, certain species are known to be quite palatable to birds. Maybe there's a stronger effect for caterpillars. So my study site was in eastern Canada, in Quebec, on the island of Montreal, and it was in the Morgan Arboretum here. It's a 245-hectare reserve, and I did my study in the sugar maple stands in the Morgan Arboretum. Here's another picture of the arboretum, and here's a picture of our lab's canopy crane, which I was fortunate enough to use to access some of the areas of the canopy. It's really a great method for accessing, although when the wind speeds pick up, it can get a bit sway, and we actually coined a new term. We weren't sure whether we should call it crane sick or canopy sick, but there can be a little bit of swaying. So to exclude birds, I actually set up wire exclosures around branches in different strata, and I sampled these along with control branches that were not did not exclude birds, and I had 20 cages in four vertical strata from the understory, lower canopy, mid canopy, up to the upper canopy region. And I sampled these six times from June to September. I also did bird surveys because I thought it was important to determine the avian community there, because different birds have different patterns of foraging that are well documented, and if you combine species information and abundance with their natural history, you might can perhaps explain patterns of abundance or just patterns that I'm seeing in insect communities. So just moving right along to what I found with the birds, I recorded over 400 individuals in my surveys, which I did in the spring, 35 species, and four common species. I think the most important species would be, in terms of insectivity, would be the ovenbird and the red-eyed vireo. Moving into the results of my insect collections, I identified to family in the field and returned the insects to the cage or the control. And you can see here that spiders, by far, were the most common thing I collected, secondarily were Coleoptera. But across the board, the cage here is in the dark color, the control and the light, sort of across the board here, I see higher abundance in the cages. To examine whether that effect was actually significantly different, I pooled my data across the season and took an average per replicate cage or control and compared. You can see the understory, lower canopy, mid canopy, and upper canopy. And in each case, there was a highly significant difference. This is what I expected. This is fairly well established in the literature. But what I found that was really interesting was this data here. If we look at the percent difference between the cage and control, you can see that it's the lowest in the understory and that it increases up to the highest in the canopy, which is actually significantly different by weighted means. This significant difference between the understory and the upper canopy, which suggests that perhaps there's a gradient in predation pressure, but at least their predation pressure is the highest in the upper canopy. So I also examined this effect across different taxa, and for spiders, this pattern held in each stratum. Differences were significantly different. Mostly the same result for Coleoptera that you can see here. There's no significant difference in the mid-canopy region, but it still approaches significance. The error bars here are 95% confidence intervals. Finally, for Lepidoptera, I was somewhat surprised by this result. I had anticipated a large effect on caterpillars, but there was actually no significant difference between the cage and control. One thing that I think is important in this case is that density was really low, and over the entire season, I collected fewer than 3 individuals per cage or control branch. And it's well known that in a lot of temperate regions, caterpillars undergo certain outbreaks, and this was a really low density year, so it's possible that if this experiment was repeated in an outbreak year, there would be very different results. So, as I said, this study sort of confirms current literature that there are strong effects of avian predators in temperate forests. There was another study done in tropical regions by Sunshine Van Bale, which found higher predation pressure in the canopy and actually no effect of birds in the understory. So that's somewhat similar to what I found. But what I'm really excited about is this sort of gradient that I observed from the understory right up to the upper canopy. I'm not exactly sure why. I don't have a mechanism yet. It's possible there's better visibility for foraging. It's also possible that avian communities in general or in this region are dominated by upper canopy foraging. And it may be that the vireos, which are really voracious insect predators and who spend all of their time in the upper canopy, are driving this. Finally, as far as taxon-specific responses go, I did find strong effects with spiders and no effects with caterpillars. I think this may be related in part to interguild predation going on between birds and spiders. And when the pressure of the birds is lifted from the spider community in the cages, the spider populations increase, and they end up controlling probably the Lepidoptera population. So aside from just the regular population cycles of Lepidoptera, this is probably another reason why Lepidoptera was so low in the cages. So just in summary, I did see this sort of gradient in predation pressure, and it seems that there is enemy-free or enemy-reduced space in the understory or lower canopy regions. And from other sampling I've done combined with this, it seems that insects are exploiting this, and the insect density per leaf surface area is actually a lot higher in the understory and the lower canopy. Spiders are really important prey items, it seems, for birds. They really increase in the absence of birds. And I would really enjoy repeating this experiment during an outbreak year of Lepidoptera to see what kinds of effects birds have in that situation. So thank you very much for your attention, and I can take any questions. Yes.
Did you do about samples of your birds or foraging intensity at those different levels?
Well, when I started out, I had wanted to do foraging, observations of them foraging, but most of the foliage is pretty thick, and most of my observations were actually not visual. They were by vocalization. I would just hear a bird, and sometimes I could not even tell if it was in the canopy or the understory. So I would like more like that, but fortunately the information exists in the literature for a lot of these temperate species about their patterns of foraging on insects, so I can mine that literature.
So are you going to be able to repeat it for another summer?
I don't know that. I just finished up my master's, and or rather I didn't finish it up, I'm in the process. And I would like to. I don't know if it's going to be possible. It depends on the caterpillars. Maybe in the following summer, if there's an outbreak, it would be fun to do.
Yeah,
but
your data are really interesting. It would be great.
Oh, yeah. I would love to do it.
Yeah. You don't need to have a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
An increase in pest suppression. There's two mechanisms that have been described for this result, and the first is the sampling effect. And this is where, as you add species to a community, you increase the chance of adding the best species, or the species that has a disproportionately high impact to the ecosystem service. The other is complementarity, and so in this case, resources use species use the resource in somewhat different ways, so that in a species-rich community, you would see the resource being used more efficiently. So in the potato cropping system that I work in, the Colorado potato beetle is an important agricultural pest that not only partitions by life stage, but spatially as well. It occurs above and below ground. The eggs are laid on the undersides of solanaceous plant leaves. There's four instars that vary in size. The last instar will burrow into the soil and pupate, and then the newly emerged adult will return back above ground. So we may be able to exploit this life history by conserving a diverse community of natural enemies that can partition their attacks on these different beetle stages, both above and below ground. Hippodamia is a lady beetle that can feed on eggs and small larvae. It's an active forager. Nabis is sort of an intermediate between active and a sit-and-wait predator that can feed on most of the above-ground stages of the potato beetle. Pterosticus is a predatory ground beetle that is nocturnal, and it feeds on the stages that are in contact with the soil surface. We also have a diverse suite of entomopathogens. Steinernema and Heterebditis are two entomopathogenic nematode genera that are associated with a bacterium that kill the host and allow the nematodes to reproduce and develop. And the prepupal stage is the most susceptible. And then finally, Bavaria is an entomopathogenic fungus that can also infect many of these stages of the potato beetle. So here we have two distinct groups, which I consider to be functional groups. We have the insect predators that feed on the beetle stages above ground, and we have the insect pathogens, which can infect the beetle stages below ground. And with these two groups, they may complement one another as the beetle stages or as the beetle population starts to go through each of the different stages. But not only do we have complementarity between these groups, we can have complementarity within a group as well. For example, within the nematode groups, we have the ambushers like Steinernema carpocapsi, which has these different behaviors of being more towards the soil surface. It can leap on their host and is really stationary. Whereas we have the cruisers, which are more of a search type of nematode in the case of Heterebditis merlatus, and they look for their host by chemical receptors. So we wanted to look at three questions. Does potato beetle control strengthen with increasing enemy diversity? Are these diversity effects due to the sampling effect, which I mentioned, or are they due to complementarity? And finally, is functional group diversity, or the pairing of predators with pathogens, is that key? So in order to test this, we adopted a few design features from the biodiversity and ecosystem functioning literature. First, we established an enemy species pool. And from this pool, we create natural enemy communities. The treatments are levels of species richness, and we use a substitutive design that keeps absolute species densities or abundances constant across species, across treatment levels. So here's our natural enemy species pool. We have our entomopathogens, Steinernema carpocapsi, Heterebditis merlatus, Bavaria bassiana, and we have our insect predators, Hippodamia convergens, Nabis, and Pterosticus millenarius. We had four treatments, and remember that treatments are levels of species richness. So we had zero, which had no enemy species present, a species richness of one, which have each enemy species in monoculture, a species richness of two, where all possible pairs of the enemy species are together, including pathogen with predator. And each of these unique compositions acts as a replicate. And then a species richness of five, where each species is deleted from the species pool of six. And again, each of the unique compositions acts as a replicate. And sticking with the substitutive design, our pathogen and predator abundance is kept constant at these levels. So our work is done at the Othello Research Station in Washington State University in the Columbia Basin. And the cages are built of PVC pipe frame. They're placed on top of a bucket that's buried into the soil. And in those cages, we place two plants. And on those plants, we have egg clutches attached. And we place 20 small larvae, which are the first and second instars, and 20 larger larvae. And the experiment is run for 28 days. And I should mention that the predators and pathogens are added 24 hours after the potato beetles are placed. And the pathogens are put onto the soil. So on the y-axis, we have potato beetle pupae and adult survivorship across natural enemies.